Welcome to a new deep dive. Today, we are setting out to unpack a massive, highly detailed 2026 joint report. It was published by the American newspaper and American TV, and it's titled "Chinese Human Wave Tactics in the Korean War."
Right, yeah, which is a huge topic.
It is. And our mission for this deep dive is actually pretty straightforward, even if the history itself isn't. We're going to try and separate a legendary military myth from a terrifying battlefield reality.
Yeah, we're basically looking specifically at what United Nations soldiers genuinely experienced on the ground versus the actual highly sophisticated tactical doctrine of the Chinese People's Volunteer
You're
Army.
right, between like 1950 and
Yeah,
1951.
exactly.
And to really grasp why this matters, I want to first, picture the scene. It's the winter of 1950. You're a UN soldier, let's say a rifleman in the US 8th Army.
Oh, man, yeah.
It is freezing. We're
Yeah.
talking severe sub-zero temperatures, and it's pitch black in these jagged, icy mountains of North Korea. You're straining your eyes into the dark, and suddenly, piercing through the freezing wind, you hear it. Bugles, whistles, gongs,
Terrifying.
and then pouring out of the darkness, what feels like an endless, overwhelming flood of enemy soldiers rushing your position. Just wave after wave after wave.
Yeah.
And for 75 years, that specific visceral image, the Chinese human wave, has been the dominant story of how the Chinese military fought in the Korean War.
It has. And the report we're looking at today sets out to deconstruct that exact image. The central thesis here is fascinating because it argues that the human wave was absolutely a real battlefield phenomenon.
Right, like they weren't just making it up.
Exactly. Those frontline UN soldiers were not hallucinating. They reported exactly what they saw. But as an explanation of China's actual military strategy, the term is just completely flawed.
Because it's taking a localized thing and making it a master plan.
Yeah, it takes a terrifying sensory experience and wrongly elevates it to a master doctrine. So, to understand the disconnect, the report dives into what military historians call the phenomenology of
Which is
combat.
basically what it feels like to be there.
Right, essentially what the battle actually looks and feels like to the individual fighting it. So, a UN rifleman's field of vision in a night fight, especially in mountainous terrain, was incredibly narrow.
Right.
In the dark, you're generally only seeing the final 100 meters of an attack. So imagine you're defending a specific saddle between two hills.
Okay.
If three or four platoon-sized Chinese assault groups hit that exact same narrow seam in your line, one right after another, your honest physiological sensory experience is that you are being hit by an endless tide of bodies.
Wow. Yeah, and when you factor in the sheer noise of the assault, it's easy to see how that translates into the feeling of this unstoppable, mindless horde.
Oh, absolutely.
But, the report has this really fascinating detail about the bugles and the gongs, because they weren't just theatrical psychological warfare designed to terrorize the UN troops.
No, not at all. Though they absolutely had that effect.
Right. But the Chinese People's Volunteer Army, or the PVA, they had virtually no radios below the battalion level.
Right.
In 1950, coordinating thousands of men in the pitch black without modern communications is a logistical nightmare.
Yeah, it's nearly impossible.
Though the whistles, the bugles, flares, that was their command and control network. It was an acoustic signaling system used to orchestrate complex tactical movements when visual cues were impossible.
Yeah, that's such a crucial point. And the translation of that frontline sensory experience up the chain of command is really where the myth crystallizes.
How so?
Well, the sheer shock of the massive Chinese intervention in late 1950 was profound. UN forces were caught completely off guard. And by March of 1951, General Douglas MacArthur was officially using the term human wave tactics in his military communique.
Oh, wow. So it went all the way to the top.
Yeah. The label attached itself perfectly to the surprise, the chaos of the night assaults, and really the terror of fighting an enemy whose true scale and methods had been totally missed by UN intelligence.
I do have to push back just a little bit on the idea that this was entirely a misunderstanding of scale, though.
Okay, sure.
Because I'm looking at the report's final judgment section, and it explicitly concludes that the human ways concept is partly true. Like, it wasn't just an illusion created by a few platoons attacking the same spot.
Right.
The report acknowledges that dense, high-casualty frontal assaults absolutely did occur during certain battles.
They did. But the report is very careful to draw a distinction between a situational tactic and an overarching doctrine.
Gotcha.
dense frontal assaults happen, but usually when Chinese troops were trying to break a particularly stubborn UN strong point, or when the physical terrain forced them into a narrow funneled approach.
Right, like a choke point.
Yeah, exactly. You also saw it when their own rigid operational timetables forced local commanders to just rush an objective before daylight. The historical error is taking those specific, brutal, situational moments and declaring that mindless mass was the foundational playbook of the entire army.
Yeah, it sounds like looking through a keyhole. You know, you're peering through this tiny opening and you see a massive high-pressure flood of water coming right at your eye.
Mm-hmm.
And because of your restricted view, what you can't see is the highly complex, deliberate plumbing system behind the wall that specifically routed the water to that exact pressure point. You just walk away thinking the entire building is made of rushing water.
That is a great analogy. And the mechanics behind that plumbing system represent a very deliberate, highly calculated doctrine. And it was born out of sheer necessity.
Because of the technology gap.
Exactly. The Chinese built their strategy to counter a massive, crippling technology gap. The UN forces, led by the US, enjoyed total air superiority. They had heavy artillery with abundant ammunition, tanks, mechanized transport, and a really robust medical evacuation system. The PVA, on the other hand, had a large pool of veteran infantry.
Right, guys who had fought in the Chinese Civil War and against Japan.
Yeah, very experienced. But they had zero tactical air cover, severely limited heavy artillery, a hodgepodge of captured small arms, and just fragile logistics.
So they couldn't fight a traditional war.
Exactly. The Chinese commander, Peng Dehuai, he understood he could not win a symmetrical firepower duel. If he lined his men up in conventional formations, they would just be obliterated by UN artillery and air power before they ever fired a shot.
Yeah.
So he changed the geometry and the time of the battle.
The report defines the true PVA doctrine as, let me get this right, infiltration envelopment warfare with localized mass.
Yes.
Which sounds incredibly technical.
Yeah.
But the mechanics of how they executed it are wild.
Mm.
Because they couldn't survive in the daylight against American planes, they moved almost entirely at night.
Right.
And they didn't just march down the roads. They moved through brutal, jagged mountain terrain that the mechanized UN forces literally assumed was impassable.
They did.
They'd send small specialized groups to probe the UN lines, specifically hunting for gaps or weak boundaries between different allied units.
And finding those seams was the critical first step. Once they located a weak point, they didn't just smash into the front line. They infiltrated.
They went around.
Yeah, they would bypass heavily defended hilltops entirely, slipping through the gaps in the dark, and drive deep into the UN rear echelons.
Wow.
Their primary targets were the command posts, the artillery positions, and most importantly, the roads. The UN forces relied entirely on their mechanization, which made them incredibly powerful, but also very roadbound and predictable.
The Chinese strategy during the second phase offensive really highlights this, especially the Battle of the Chongqing River in November 1950.
Oh, absolutely.
The Chinese 38th Army didn't form a giant horizontal line and push south like a traditional offensive. They moved deep behind the lines and cut off the U.S. 8th Army's withdrawal routes.
Mm-hmm.
They created what became known as the Kunari Gauntlet. By the time the U.N. forces realized they needed to pull back, they were forced to drive their mechanized columns through miles of narrow roads where Chinese troops already held the high ground on both sides and had established hard roadblocks.
Yeah, and that maneuver at Chongqing resulted in one of the most devastating defeats in U.S. military history.
It's just wild.
And the psychological impact of being attacked from the front, the flanks, and the rear simultaneously in the dark while your communication lines are severed, that is exactly what birthed the feeling of drowning in a human sea.
Yeah, it was designed to create isolated pockets of panic.
Exactly, and force a disorganized retreat.
But I'm struggling to reconcile a major paradox here. You have a United Nations force that is fully mechanized, has total air supremacy, and vast aerial reconnaissance capabilities.
Yeah.
How do hundreds of thousands of enemy infantry just walk through the mountains and set up massive, elaborate traps in the rear without anyone noticing until it's too late?
Well, it was a catastrophic intelligence failure. Heavy driven by institutional blindness at MacArthur's headquarters in Tokyo.
Right.
Particularly by his intelligence chief, General Charles Willoughby. They simply refused to believe the Chinese would intervene in such massive numbers because it didn't fit their preconceived strategic assumptions.
Wow. Just ignored the sign.
Yeah. But mechanically, the Chinese achieved this surprise through unparalleled camouflage discipline. Because U.S. aerial reconnaissance controlled the skies, Chinese units would march at night and then completely vanish during the day.
Just hide in plain sight.
Exactly. If a reconnaissance plane flew over, soldiers were ordered to freeze perfectly still in the snow and brush.
That is intense.
And anyone who broke camouflage discipline could be shot on the spot. So the Chinese were physically present in the hundreds of thousands, but they were entirely invisible to a UN command structure that was looking for conventional World War II-style mechanized troop buildups on the main roads.
But holding that element of surprise only works for so long. The report outlines how the UN command eventually cracked the code, and it required completely reorganizing how the U.S. 8th Army fought.
It did.
By early 1951, General Matthew Ridgway took command, and he diagnosed the exact vulnerability in the Chinese system.
Right. Ridgway recognized that the entire Chinese infiltration strategy relied on UN units panicking when they found their roads cut.
Because the standard instinct was to abandon the defensive position, get in the trucks, and try to fight their way out down the highway.
Which played right into the ambushes at places like Kunuri. So Ridgway's solution was to completely deny the Chinese that isolation.
Right.
He tightened the front lines to remove the gaps, and he instituted the absolute requirement of all-around defense.
And the Battle of Chipyongni in February 1951 is the pivotal turning point the report highlights for this new strategy. You have the U.S. 23rd Infantry Regiment and a French battalion completely surrounded by Chinese forces.
Mm-hmm.
It's the exact same scenario that caused absolute disaster just a few months prior.
Mm-hmm.
But this time, they didn't try to load up the trucks and retreat. They dug in, formed a tight, compact 360-degree perimeter, and just held their ground.
And the geometry of a 360-degree perimeter fundamentally breaks the Chinese doctrine.
How so?
Well, if there is no gap to infiltrate, there's no flank to turn, and there's no vulnerable rear echelon to attack.
Whoa.
The PVA launched repeated massive night assaults from multiple directions against the perimeter at Chipyongni. At the point of contact with forces massing to try and break the ring, it looked very much like the legendary human wave.
Sure.
But the defenders had integrated their combined arms. They had tanks positioned in the line, anti-aircraft weapons firing flat into the approaching infantry, and pre-planned artillery already registered on all the avenues of approach.
Just waiting for them.
Exactly. The objective was simply to maintain unit cohesion through the night. If the perimeter could hold out until daylight, the entire tactical advantage of the Chinese evaporated. Once the sun came up, UN air support arrived, and the exposed Chinese infantry caught in the open were decimated.
Wow. And the report actually mentions that Chinese retrospective military accounts studied Chipyongni as a major operational failure.
Yeah, they do.
Like, they realized in real time that you cannot defeat a modern, well-fortified combined arms perimeter just by funneling manpower into it. The math simply doesn't work.
Right. And Ridgway's successor, General James Van Fleet, took that exact mathematical realization and scaled it up to an industrial level.
The Van Fleet load.
Yes. He instituted a doctrine explicitly designed to expend steel and fire, not men. To break the back of the Chinese infantry assaults during the spring offensive of 1951, U.S. artillery batteries were authorized to fire up to 300 rounds a day per 105-millimeter gun.
300 rounds a day. That is insane.
The logistical apparatus required to supply that volume of heavy munitions to the front lines was staggering. But it meant the UN was unleashing an unimaginable continuous wall of high explosives that made localized mass attacks suicidal.
Which brings up the other side of the equation. How were the Chinese supplying their own massive offensives against this firepower? The UN commanders started referring to the Chinese capability as the 7-day offensive, which operates kind of like a logistics clock.
Right.
I try to visualize the Chinese army at this stage like a deep sea diver holding their breath. Because the U.S. had total uncontested control of the skies, Chinese supply trusts were routinely destroyed if they moved during daylight.
Yeah, they couldn't move anything during the day.
So the PVA had to rely on hundreds of thousands of human porters and pack animals moving at night over brutal mountain trails. That meant an individual Chinese soldier could only carry about a week's worth of food, ammunition, and grenades on their back.
Right.
Once that 7-day clock ran out, the diver had to surface for air. They literally lacked the material infrastructure to sustain a continuous offensive beyond that point.
And the logistics clock is a crucial mechanism for understanding the stalemate. Ridgway and Van Fleet learned to exploit that exact rhythm. Instead of holding brittle lines that could be shattered, they would conduct controlled fighting withdrawals.
Drawing them out.
Exactly. They forced the Chinese to advance, stretch their already fragile supply lines even further over bombed-out terrain, and expend their carried ammunition. Then, right when that seven-day clock ran out, when the Chinese infantry were starving, exhausted, and critically low on bullets, the UN would launch massive, devastating counterattacks spearheaded by armor and uncontested air power.
Knowing how outgunned they were, and knowing how fragile their logistics were, it forces a really dark question about the casualties. Because the whole myth of the Asiatic Horde relies on the assumption that life was totally cheap to the Chinese command. That they were just mindlessly feeding bodies into a meat grinder without a second thought. Did the commanders actually care about the massive losses they were taking?
The report addresses that dynamic extensively, and it requires parsing a very fine line. Chinese commanders were undeniably willing to accept casualty rates that would result in a mutiny or court-martial in a Western military.
Sure.
However, acceptance of brutal casualties is not the same thing as indifference.
Okay.
Chinese official records and post-war analyses show that high command was actually highly critical of wasteful, unproductive losses. A commander might order a unit to assault a fortified hill three times in one night, taking devastating losses, but only if the operational calculus dictated that taking that specific hill would sever the retreat route of an entire UN division.
So as a means to an end.
Casualties were viewed as a terrible but necessary currency to purchase a strategic breakthrough before their logistical window closed. When attacks failed to produce that payoff, local commanders were heavily reprimanded for poor reconnaissance or failing to concentrate their forces properly.
They weren't just throwing guys away.
No. They understood their veteran troops were not an infinite resource. In fact, the staggering loss of experienced NCOs and junior officers in those 1950 and 1951 campaigns permanently degraded the PVO's ability to execute those complex, stealthy night infiltrations later in the war.
Okay, so if the UN command had essentially solved this tactical puzzle by the middle of 1951 and the conflict settled into a grinding, static war of attrition along the 38th parallel, why on earth has this mindless human wave myth survived so stubbornly for 75 years?
It's a great question.
I mean, it's still prevalent in movies and popular histories and just in how Western culture remembers the Korean War.
Well, the myth endured for so long because it perfectly served the psychological and political narratives of almost everyone involved.
How do you mean?
Look at the situation from the perspective of the Western media and the public in late 1950. The UN had just pulled off a miraculous war-winning victory at Incheon. The headlines were universally declaring that the troops would be home by Christmas.
Right. Everyone thought it was over.
Then, suddenly, the Eighth Army is in a desperate, freezing, catastrophic retreat. The press and the politicians had to explain a humiliating defeat to an angry public without admitting that their brilliant, heavily armed generals had been completely outmaneuvered by an agrarian army.
Wow. So blaming it on an inexhaustible, unnatural force of nature is like the ultimate out.
Yes.
The narrative becomes, we didn't get outsmarted by superior tactics. We were just buried by a million guys.
Yeah.
It completely shifts the blame away from bad generalship and intelligence failures.
It is a profoundly comforting excuse. And as the Cold War deepened over the following decades, that specific imagery fit flawlessly into the broader geopolitical narrative.
Right.
The West positioned itself as the bastion of technology, individualism, and reason, while framing the communist bloc as a faceless, collective, mindless engine of manpower. What is equally fascinating, though, is how Chinese propaganda handled the myth.
Oh.
They didn't entirely reject the imagery. They just flipped the ideological meaning.
Wait, they leaned into the idea of the human wave?
They leaned into the human element. Mao Zedong heavily promoted the concept of spirit over steel. Chinese domestic propaganda celebrated the sheer willpower, the collective heroism, and the deep political consciousness of their soldiers overcoming superior American industrial technology.
Oh, wow.
They obviously ignored the mindless mass implication of the Western myth, but they enthusiastically embraced the narrative that their human quality and ideological purity were the decisive factors on the battlefield. You have this rare historical phenomenon where two geopolitical enemies were both heavily invested in promoting slightly different, culturally tailored versions of the exact same oversimplification.
That is wild. Which brings us to the core of why this history matters to the person listening right now. We aren't just dissecting a 75-year-old tactical doctrine for the sake of trivia.
Definitely not.
The danger of mischaracterizing a rival's success as mindless brute force is that it acts as an intellectual shortcut. Whether you are studying military history, tracking global economic competition, or analyzing a new disruptor in your specific business industry.
Right.
If you dismiss an opponent's complex adaptive strategy as just a human wave, or accuse them of just dumping cheap products or just using brute force, you are actively preventing yourself from learning how they actually beat you. You cannot outmaneuver an opponent that you refuse to properly analyze.
And that is the ultimate practical takeaway of the historical report. The U.S. 8th Army only stopped retreating and stabilized the peninsula when commanders like Ridgway and Van Fleet stopped treating the Chinese as a magical, inexhaustible horde and started analyzing them as a conventional, resource-constrained military organization with very specific logistical limits and geometric tactics.
Right. They stopped panicking at the water and took the time to diagnose the plumbing.
Exactly.
It is a masterclass in separating terrifying perception from mechanical reality.
Yeah.
But it also leaves us with a lingering thought about how we measure threats today. We look back at this history and easily judge figures like MacArthur and Willoughby harshly.
Sure.
They had the intelligence, they had the aerial photos, but they filtered out the reality of a massive infiltration force because they were only looking for conventional mechanized armies moving down main roads.
It forces a much more modern question. We judge them for their institutional blindness, but look at the world today. We live in an era of constant surveillance, AI data scraping, and endless metrics. We think we see everything.
Yeah.
But if the human wave myth was born because an advanced military couldn't measure an opponent who played by a different set of rules, what metrics are we blindly relying on right now?
That's a great point.
Whether it's decentralized tech disruption, asymmetrical market competition, or shifting global influence, how much invisible movement is happening right in front of us simply because our modern algorithms are still looking for traditional definitions of mass? When a new threat or competitor enters the field, are we dismissing them as a disorganized mess just because their tactics don't fit the models we are trained to measure?
We think we have the perfect digital X-ray machine, but we might just be staring into the dark again, waiting to hear the bugles. That is something to mull over. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.